Peter B. Collins News and Comment. Wednesday, November 6, 2013. The day after some midterm elections, off-year elections around the country. Are you confused?
People moving up, people moving in. Why? Because of the color of the skin.
Run, 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 but you sure can't hide.
And I, boy, and I, a 2 for 2. Vote for me and I'll set you free.
And some of the elections had some interesting outcomes, but I hasten to add that you shouldn't draw any deep inferences or describe these as big trends. Because, you know, in these off-year elections, it's easy to explain the factors that cause the outcome by local issues and local politics much more than national trends. That said, many people are relieved that Ken Cuccinelli was defeated in Virginia. He's a right-wing Tea Party nut, a guy who was pandering to the religious right at Lynchburg, Virginia, in ways that were really disgusting. I mean, he wanted to outlaw sodomy and oral sex, and somebody needs to tell him just how out of touch he is. However, the defeat of Ken Cuccinelli occurred by only 3 points. There was a Libertarian in the race who picked up some. And Terry McAuliffe, a toady of the Clinton family, a bag man for the Clintons for many years, won the race. Now, my niece Hannah worked on that campaign. And so for her, I'm happy. I'm happy that the campaign is over and that her candidate won. But Terry McAuliffe is a guy I've met on several occasions. He oozes slime. And his business dealings, which you can research at Mother Jones Magazine's website, motherjones.com, and other places, really are tawdry at best. He has used his connections to the Clintons to make business deals that have been highly profitable to him, often with almost zero risk on his part. Kind of like the way Hillary scored the $100,000 deal from the Stevens Financial Group in Arkansas way back when. And so Terry McAuliffe's victory is a cautionary note, because he's a say-anything, do-anything candidate, an opportunist. And the fact that he's a Democrat, described as moderate, won in a red state, I think it's the first Democratic governor since the early 1990s, these issues will be used to play him up as a future candidate, of course, after Hillary has been through her cycle. And, you know, the idea that Terry McAuliffe could become a major factor in American politics or even just the Democratic Party is something that we should be concerned about. Not a surprise that Chris Christie won a significant victory in his reelection campaign in New Jersey. He, of course, has had his stomach surgery, hoping to lose some weight and become a more attractive candidate, hoping to run for president or maybe be picked for VP by the Republicans in 2016. And, you know, he's another person we're going to have to watch, because he's quite an opportunist himself. And he has cozied up to the Koch brothers. While he is not explicitly a Tea Party guy, he knows how to play the game well enough to win some of those votes and, more importantly, collect a lot of that money. And there were some interesting ballot measures that were voted on, again, mostly locally across the country. And some of them, like at SeaTac Airport, where that area outside of Seattle has imposed a new minimum wage, mostly aimed at the hourly workers, entry-level workers who clean airplanes and the airport itself. And there were a few other good measures that were passed across the country yesterday. Now, we have a Tea Party entrant in the race for governor here in California next year. His name is Tim Donnelly. He's from Southern California. And he is throwing his hat into the Republican ring. Abel Maldonado is the only other announced candidate on the Republican ticket for governor next year. And he's described as a moderate. He supports marriage rights, and I think he might even be in favor of legalizing marijuana. And for the Orange County, real diehard Republicans and Tea Party members across the state, he's just too damn liberal. So it'll be interesting to see how that shapes up. There is a third candidate likely to enter on the Republican side, and he was one of the people who ran the TARP fund, and he's expected to announce in the next couple of days. I don't have his name in front of me and can't think of it offhand, so I'll update you on that in a few days when, in fact, he does announce his candidacy. Today marks 2 weeks in illegal detention for Roger Shuler, the journalist and blogger from LegalSchnauzer.blogspot.com. He remains locked up in Shelby County, Alabama, on a contempt citation for committing journalism. And I don't have any significant updates to offer you today, I'm sorry to say. But I would encourage you, if you are willing and able, to go to the Shuler website, LegalSchnauzer.blogspot.com. There's a PayPal button near the top of the page, and if you can support them, well, this is a very crucial time for Roger and Carol Shuler. Many of my listeners have already contributed, and I thank you for that. I'm also grateful to the people who subscribe to this program and give me the validation and the funds to keep it going. And that includes people like Jay Tarpoff, Steve Lane, Linda Gray, Michael Petty. You can join their ranks. Just go to my website, peterbcollins.com, under my picture on the homepage. Follow the links to sign up. $5 a month, you can cancel anytime. Or the best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And Mary Vogt just signed up in the last 24 hours. Thank you, Mary. I really appreciate that. I'd like to mention your name, too, so don't delay. Step on up at peterbcollins.com. You can also steer your web business to godaddy.com. They have incredible deals. Right now, if you sign up for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, the fees start at just $1.99 a month, and they'll give you your domain name free. For a screaming deal at GoDaddy, follow the link in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Well, today I spent some time palling around with Bill Ayers and his wife, Bernardine Dorn. They came out of the Weather Underground, the Students for a Democratic Society, early protesters of the Vietnam War. Bill's new book is called Public Enemy, and I trotted out a Public Enemy tune to open up the podcast. I hope you'll listen, because he and Bernardine, I think, are very interesting people. And his book is not about Barack Obama, the president. It's about how, because Bill Ayers and Bernardine Dorn knew their neighbor, Barack Obama, attended some fundraisers, Bill served on a community nonprofit board with Obama, that they became targets in the 2008 election. And it was the Hillary Clinton campaign who served them up as a reason why people should distrust Barack Obama. And they were coupled with Reverend Jeremiah Wright. It was a really ugly time. And in this excerpt from our conversation, Bill Ayers talks about what it was like to be cartoonized and marginalized. And he took advice of other people to lay low and not talk to the media after he was attacked in the presidential campaign of 2008.
But outside was an encampment on our front lawn that was quite frenzied, and it got more and more frenzied. So I would go out and, five people would shove microphones in my face, or I'd go to the local coffee shop. It was surreal and it was strange, but I found that it was calming to not pay attention to it and to not read about myself in the papers. If the kids wanted me to know something, like that I was a character on Saturday Night Live, they would let me know and then I would know. But
how did you learn the line, the soundbite line that was crafted and delivered by Sarah Palin, that Obama had been palling around with terrorists?
Yes, that deathless phrase was, when she first uttered it, I believe it was in Michigan, I'm not certain, but she uttered it again and again. The first time she uttered it, the crowd started chanting, "Kill him, kill him." And I wasn't sure which they wanted to kill, Obama or me or both. It was surreal. And that little soundbite the kids had sent us, and we looked at it. But But the fact is that we never felt, and I never felt, that we were really in danger. I mean, and partly this is a
genetic flaw.
A genetic flaw.
I mean, we got death threats that are unbelievable, yeah. Really. But well, but lots of people get them. That's the interesting thing. People who stand up, you know, in independent bookstores and have controversial speakers get them. So people get targeted like this. And I think once it happens to you, you decide, what can I do? I'm just going to pile these up in some outbox, mm-hmm. and not pay attention.
You know, I look at Glenn Greenwald as a model for right now. Of somebody, you could say, well, isn't he going to get taken down? Isn't he going to be arrested? Isn't he going to be? And I think that what he decided to do was to be noisier, mm-hmm. not quieter, because being noisier, you find you have a lot of allies, actually. You have a lot of people who are willing to step up. But if you were hunkered down in your bunker, you wouldn't know that those allies were even there. So I'm kind of admiring the dance that Greenwald is involved
in. And Madea is another example.
Madea Benjamin's another one.
Or Angela Davis. I mean, people who go right. on mm-hmm. and body forth all the time because they believe in what they're doing and their own integrity. That's
And there's another point, and I would say this is true for Madea, this is true for Bill Maher, this is true for Angela Davis. The attack on an Angela Davis or a Bill Maher or a Susan Sontag or an Edward Said, The victim of that attack isn't just Edward Said. The real target is the history teacher, the high school history teacher in Pennsylvania, or the English teacher in Stockton. These are the people who are being warned, if you step out of line, this could happen to you. So if they can go after a giant like Said or Sontag, what chance do I have? That's all the more reason, when you are targeted, to stand up. Your friend going to jail rather than taking down the names off of his website and so on. That's mm-hmm. what we have to do, because that's what makes the emperor back up.
The complete interview with Bill Ayers and his wife Bernadine Dorn released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, and I highly recommend both the interview and the book when you have a moment to pursue them. Well, we have to leave it to John Stewart to speak the truth about when our leaders don't speak the truth. In the corporate media these days, they will broadcast a lie. They will suggest it's not true. They'll use other people to say that what you just heard was a lie. But you rarely hear a reporter or an anchor say, huh, that was a lie. Well, Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, America's leading news and commentary television program, nailed Barack Obama last night for the promise that he made during the run-up to the passage of Obamacare. If you want to keep your doctor, you can. If you want to keep your insurance, you can. And as you listen to this excerpt, Stewart very clearly shows how Obama is now trying to wiggle out of the flat statement that he made, that you can keep your insurance, period. Well, Stewart is unrelenting on Obama, and then, as you'll hear in this excerpt, he turns his sights on the lying sacks of shit who are Republicans, who have been determined to bring this effort down from the beginning. So take a listen to this, and then I will interrupt it as he starts the parade of Republicans to point out something else you should know.
Now, here in the States, we're still working out some of the fine print on our new health care system. Right now, there's been some talk that the President of the United States was less than 100% honest with some of his health care rhetoric.
If you like your current plan, you will be able to keep it.
Did he just say if we like our current plan, we'll be able to keep it?
Let me repeat that. If you like your plan, you'll be able to keep it.
I thought that was what you said.
If you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor.
Want to add any caveats to that? Because it sounds kind of definitive.
We will keep this promise to the American people. If you like your doctor, you will be able to keep your doctor, period. If you like your health care plan, you will be able to keep your health care plan, period.
Period! First of all, I do not think you're supposed to read the punctuation in the speeches. Pretty sure you're supposed to just let that stuff go by. And second of all, How would that definitive statement sound post-implementation of said new health care act when it has become abundantly clear that you cannot always keep your plan or your doctor?
If you have or had one of these plans before the Affordable Care Act came into law, and you really liked that plan, what we said was you could keep it if it hasn't changed since the law's passed.
No. What you said was you can keep it. Period. Now what you said there was more like you can keep your health care plan. Ellipses. Comma. Because it may no longer meet the minimum requirements, or your insurance company may stop offering individual plans, or some other odd bureaucratic unintended offshoot. Period. Emoticon denoting a combination of embarrassment and arrogance.
Did I do that? So, yes, the president was somewhat dishonest. Was somewhat dishonest about the promise of his health care program. But here's the weird part. His opponents have been lying like motherfuckers about its effects.
It is estimated that Obamacare will increase taxes over $1 trillion and add $6 trillion to the deficit.
We're looking at probably $20,000 in premiums next year. And we don't even have insurance for our daughter who has a pre-existing condition.
Yeah, $95 fine is which a lot of young people are going to take in order to avoid prison time or whatever ramifications.
Vladimir Lenin, he said, socialized medicine is the keystone of the arch to the socialist state.
So there you have part of John Stewart's expose, first on the lies of President Obama about the health care reform, and then the lies of Republicans trying to sink it. And what's interesting is I got a news alert today from alternet.org, which is a left-leaning news site based here in San Francisco. And I don't look at Alternet that often. I know they're there, but for whatever reasons, they don't really grab me. It was very interesting because the Alternet promo email talked about John Stewart and Obamacare, but left out the part about Obama dissembling. And it starts really with the second part that you heard just before I faded it out, where he talks about the way Republicans have misled, distorted, and otherwise lied about health care reform. It's very interesting to see the way the political dynamics work. And now we have proposals from some Democrats, they've just surfaced this week, saying, gosh, you know, this isn't ready and we ought to wait. We ought to find a way to delay the launch of Obamacare. And I do understand the political pickle. The White House is afraid that if they give any concessions whatsoever, that the Republicans, particularly the majority in the House, will pounce. And while it's been a messy launch, I don't even support the whole program and the way it cements the control of insurance companies over health care delivery in this country, it would be even worse to stall it out. Because the health insurance companies have already canceled many people's policies. Others are seeing huge rate increases. Obamacare never attempted to address any of those things, and that's one of the reasons I was critical at the time it passed. And so they're just backed into a big political corner. And it's going to be ugly and messy going forward. I don't see any way around that. Two stories today about Apple Computer in Cupertino, California. Apple has announced that they are going to open a manufacturing plant in Arizona and hire 2,000 Americans. Isn't that amazing? They're going to shift some production back to the United States. This is the creation of a second U.S. plant in less than a year. It's in Mesa, Arizona. It'll produce laboratory-grown sapphire crystals that are used in the iPhone 5S fingerprint scanner. And Jan Brewer, the idiot governor of Arizona, is just jumping for joy. Well, I guess she's allowed to do that once in a while. The plant will be run with solar and geothermal energy, and it is designed in collaboration with the local utility, the Salt River Project. So I commend Apple for bringing manufacturing back to the U.S. and hiring American workers. It's something I've been asking them to do for a while. Apple also challenged the United States government today after publishing its first report on the number and type of requests for information about users and devices that have come from governments all over the world. You won't be surprised that the United States government is the leading entity that demands information on users from Apple. And Apple's pushing back, quote, "We have no interest in amassing personal information about our customers. We protect personal conversations by providing end-to-end encryption over iMessage and FaceTime. We don't store location data, map searches, or Siri requests in any identifiable form." Well, that's comforting. But of the 31 countries on the list, the U.S. was far and away number one, demanding information on more than 2,000 accounts. Britain, a mere 141, Spain, 104, Germany, 93, Canada, China, Norway, 6 requests of Apple. And Apple used this to complain that U.S. restrictions prevent it from disclosing the precise number of national security orders and the number of accounts affected by those orders. Figures for the U.S. were given within ranges of 1,000. And Apple said, "We strongly oppose this gag order. We've made the case for relief from these restrictions in meetings and discussions with the White House, the Attorney General, congressional leaders, and the courts." And this is in part a result of lawsuits from the San Francisco-based Electronic Frontier Foundation. Chloe's excited about that. And EFF has commended Apple for not automatically complying with government information requests. According to the data, for example, when Britain made requests, only 37% of them were honored by Apple. 22% for Spain, 6% for Germany, but the U.S. will not permit them to release similar statistics about their activities against Americans in the United States. From time to time, I talk about the scandalous situation at the United States Postal Service. Before I dive in, I just want to mention that last week on Thursday at 5 p.m., I mailed packages of Kona Coffee and bonus books to individuals who have signed up recently for annual subscriptions. And via Facebook, I found out from Bob Levin in Portland that his package arrived early on Saturday morning. Now, our postal service works, but there are various forces, including UPS and FedEx, who want to see it marginalized, if not completely dismantled. And one of the ways they're achieving this is through acts of Congress where they force the Postal Service to either pay or show on their books $5.5 billion a year in health care fund payments for future retirees. They don't owe the money today. They're the only entity in the United States that is required to pay all this up in advance. And over the last few years, $32 billion of the Postal Service losses are due to the health funding requirement. And there's a House committee that's passed a postal reform bill, but it's not certain whether it'll come to the floor for a vote this year. The Senate has a postal reform bill, but hasn't taken a vote, and it seems to be being sent back for rewrite. Meanwhile, the Postal Service continues to suffer with huge losses, and some of them are real losses because people aren't using the mail as much anymore. Bills are sent online, and really it's packages of people buying online that are the only growth area for the post office. And so we have to be honest that it is a declining business, but the books have been cooked by the Congress to make it appear even worse. Now, Mark Crispin Miller from NYU runs a listserv, and he forwards articles and web posts from various sources around the world. And I have never seen this website, Zero Hedge, before. Its slogan is, "On a long enough timeline, the survival rate for everyone drops to zero." So it's an environmental website. And in a post attributed to Tyler Durden, they use government sources, That is NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, to report to us that there is a huge, toxic, perhaps radioactive debris field that was generated by the earthquake and tsunami at Fukushima, Japan, in 2011. And over a million tons of this debris is floating in a large, what do you call it? It's kind of a floating dump of this material that was basically thrown out into the ocean by the earthquake and tsunami. Some interesting factoids. 5 million tons of debris washed into the ocean. 70% of that reportedly sank near the coast of Japan. But high wind items have reached the Pacific Northwest since 2011-2012. And NOAA expects widely scattered debris may show up intermittently along shorelines for a long period of time. Now, this is largely unreported, and I don't want to create any hysteria, but our government should be honest with us. The Hawaiian Islands should know if, when debris washes up on shore, there's any risk to human health. And like so many issues, the fallout, both literal and figurative, from Fukushima is downplayed by the corporate media. And I deplore that. It puts it all at greater risk. Speaking of that corporate media, CBS broadcast a package on 60 Minutes this past Sunday, which I did not see. It was about the Benghazi attacks, and it was reported by Laura Logan, who, I will just tell you, is a reporter I don't particularly trust. She's beautiful. She leapt over other reporters with more experience to join the 60 Minutes team. And she had a checkered episode or tenure covering the Iraq War for CBS. So CBS is being hammered because the reported broadcast has been taken apart and creates more questions than it answers. Now, according to the New York Times, the 60 Minutes report centered on an account from a guy named Dylan Davies, a security contractor who said he was at the site in Libya on September 11, 2012, the night of the attack. He appeared on camera with Logan under the pseudonym Morgan Jones and described having an active role during the fighting that took place. And the Washington Post outed Morgan Jones as Dylan Davies. But after the CBS report aired, articles on websites including the Washington Post and Media Matters referred to an incident report written by Mr. Davies, or at least attributed to him, that differed in many respects from the account that he gave. And in particular, the incident report said that he had remained at his villa during the attack and contradicted a statement he made to Laura Logan that he had seen the dead body of the Ambassador Hill who was killed in that attack. And so here we have the leading corporate media news magazine on a story that is highly controversial. And again, I did not see this broadcast. But clearly, CBS is on the defensive. They have acknowledged that Dylan Davies published a book through a company, I think Simon & Schuster, owned by CBS, and they acknowledged they failed to disclose that. But I think the factual failings are even more significant. Finally, today we want to commend the land of Lincoln. Illinois is on the way to legalizing marriage equality. And boys can marry boys, girls can marry boys in Illinois probably next June if everything falls into place and the governor signs the legislation as he has promised to do. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. Be sure to check out the interview podcast with Bill Ayers on my website today.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.